From UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation, this is Tales from the South. Recorded in front of a live audience every Tuesday night during dinner at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas.
I was absolutely not going into a dark parking lot with some guy I had just met whom I only knew as Boomhauer. It just wasn't going to happen.
A strangled squawk came from his throat and his hand jerked to his mouth. Something definitely wasn't right. This wasn't what he was supposed to do.
I was known on the air as Fedge Nellywell, the Eternal Clone. It would take too long to explain why. Just know that UFOs were involved.
Sit back, relax, and let's reconnect with the power of a story.
Saints of the rain is softly falling. Indian summer kind of night. Harvest moon slowly creeping up the sky to hang alive. Indian summer kind of night. Harvest moon slowly creeping up the sky to hang light. Up the sky to hang light.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Amy Garland and Nick Devlin? Y'all like the music? Amy Garland and Nick Devlin bring you Louisiana and Scotland combined. They've been playing around Little Rock for years and are about to put out their third record, Still Unnamed. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark can be heard on legendary bluesman John Weston's CDs, Got to Deal with the Blues and Blues at Daybreak. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? This week, our stories are all about the unexpected, when things take a turn that wasn't anticipated. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Donna Dillahunty's idea to make the perfect dessert doesn't exactly go according to plan. And we'll end the night with Jeff Llewellyn as a normal night becomes something not normal at all. But let's start the night with Allie Sumner as a chance meeting unexpectedly takes a turn in Close Encounters.
Oh. One chilly spring evening, I was sitting on a bench on my college campus with a friend of mine, listening to him playing guitar. In the middle of Seminole wind, an obviously very drunk man stumbled toward us. Making himself comfortable, he plopped down next to me on the bench and said his name was Sam and nice to meet you. At least that's what I think he tried to say. I, having a rather large chew in my mouth at the time, leaned over to spit and shook his hand. His eyes widened, and he basically shouted at me, "You chew? Can girls do that?" Being a girl who obviously had a water Copenhagen in my mouth, I fought with my inner smart aleck and decided to be nice. Kinda. I said, obviously. It was 2010, and I was attending Oklahoma State University Institute of Technology. Don't let the name fool you into thinking we were all there taking some high-tech classes. Oh, I'm sure those people were there, somewhere. But the school is mainly known for its various auto mechanics, Caterpillar, Komatsu, and heavy equipment classes. Or to sum it all up, rednecks. Having lost interest in this anomaly, Sam had then noticed my friend's guitar. He took it, turned to me, and began to play what I think was supposed to be a Garth Brooks song. As he was playing, he kept scooting closer and closer to me on the bench. Between sips from his styrofoam cup, he would wink at me. By the time he began playing a slow version of Neon Moon, I was almost in my friend's lap in my unsuccessful attempt to keep scooting away from Sam. I had run out of bench. With only half an inch of bench left between us, in mid-scoot, his phone rang. Thankfully, I had a reprieve from his serenading while he answered it. Because he had been drinking, when alcohol is involved, people feel the need to shout instead of talk. He informed the guy on the phone loudly of his current whereabouts and that this fella should make his way over because there was this really cool girl there who dipped. The conversation ended there, and I know that my left ear was thankful. My friend took back his guitar and began to play. In the distance, a very tall figure was beginning to take shape out of the fog. As the figure stumbled his way to the bench, I found myself thinking that if this is going to be a repeat of the Sam incident, then I was just going to remove myself from the bench. Sam shouted to me that this was his friend Boomhauer. Boomhauer stuck a gigantic hand out at me, and I shook it, hoping he would not crush my hand in the process. Boomhauer let go of my hand and informed me that he didn't know what happened to his shirt. Being as it wasn't all that warm out, and if I'm to be honest, he was attractive, I wasn't too bothered by it. So I just shrugged. Boomhauer also carried with him a styrofoam cup. As the night progressed, I myself had a little to drink, and Boomhauer stood in front of me, leaning heavily against the wall, staring at me. And when I say staring, I mean staring. Every time I looked forward, he was death staring me. I mean, it was making me nervous. I kept expecting him to look away or at least tell me what I had done to deserve his laser beam stare. He just kept staring. My friend continued to play guitar. More friends came. I had several more drinks and Boomhauer death stared me. I tried to turn away from him. I tried to sling my hair over my face. I tried to stare back. It was all to no avail. The death stare continued. After several hours, and out of nowhere, Boomhauer loudly informed the group that he needed to go to his truck to get something, the death stare straight at me as he said it. I was absolutely not going into a dark parking lot with some guy I had just met whom I only knew as Boomhauer. It just wasn't going to happen. Much to my relief, the whole group decided to go. I got a piggyback ride from a friend whose name I actually knew. I was struggling to keep my purse from hitting my friend in the head when Boomhauer offered to carry it for me. It had a very small strap. As he was sliding it over his arm, he flexed his bicep multiple times. I couldn't help myself, so I laughed. Taking my laughter as encouragement, he flexed a few more times. Slower, I guess, so I could really appreciate it. Being the ego builder that I am, I laughed again. After the parking lot adventure, it was very late, my head was spinning, and I decided to call it a night. One of my friends walked me to my room. Getting to my dorm, I was hit with a sudden wave of nausea and parked myself in front of the toilet. My friend sat in the bathroom with me. As I was attending to my issue, my phone began blowing up with text messages. Someone had given Boomhauer my number. My friend was reading them to me, and they went something like this. "I know you don't know me at all, but there is something about you. I would like to hang out and take you out on a date. I think you're really cool, and I would really like to get to know you. They kept on in this fashion for roughly 5 text messages. Between heaves, with shaking hands, I eloquently replied, "Okay." Truth be told, I was relieved that Boomhauer's death stare turned out to be only admiration. That weekend, we went out on a date. I found out that his real name was not Boomhauer, but Daniel. Who would have thought? Daniel was from Pine Bluff, Arkansas. 3 months later, Daniel asked me to marry him. 3 months after that, we got married. I then moved to Arkansas. Considering the way we met is not the most romantic, I think we are going to have to slightly alter it for our future children.
Allie Sumner is from Kiefer, Oklahoma. She attended Oklahoma State University Institute of Technology for Civil Engineering and Chrysler Automotive. She works for Waste Management as a landfill gas technician. Allie is married to Daniel Sumner of Pine Bluff, Arkansas. In our next story, Donna Dillahunty doesn't know it, but something unexpected is hiding in plain sight in Blackberry Cobbler.
City girl meets country boy. They fall deeply in love in spite of their different backgrounds. Fairy tale wedding unites them, and romantic honeymoon follows. Then, it's back to the real world. Oh, don't get me wrong, they are still very much in love. But somehow, morning hair and bad breath change a person's perspective a teensy bit. In July of 88, Reed and I were adapting to this new married life thing. Some things we did extremely well together, and other things, let's just say we worked on them. I wanted to surprise Reed with something really special. Remember, I was a newlywed and still excited about doing all of the precious little things that would make him smile. And when a friend invited me to go blackberry picking, I had a brainstorm. Blackberry cobbler. He liked that. I could make him one. Now, it's important to know that I had never made a cobbler. But at 22, I was more than confident that I could do it. Surely it couldn't be that difficult. Naively, I bounced from the house with my little basket swinging from my arm and jumped in my friend's car. I had a perfect image in my mind of how the day would unfold. How domestic. How storybook-like, how Leave It to Beaver. What a sweet July day this would be. Nope, City Girl had never picked blackberries. Did you know that blackberry bushes have thorns? I think I found every single one of them on those bushes, more than once. No one warned me to wear long sleeves. My fingers, hands, and arms were covered in scrapes inside of 2 minutes. I kept telling myself that I was doing this for Reed. It was hot and sticky, and there were disgusting bugs everywhere. This city girl didn't like bugs either. My skin felt like it was crawling with no-see-ums. I scratched and slapped and scratched some more. At one point, I was quite certain that an army of critters had crawled up my shorts legs and invaded my personal space. This was not a part of my image of a dreamy June cleaver day. We were late enough in the season that the berries were almost overripe, and many burst in my hands as I tried to pick them. Consequently, I wore more berries than I picked. I think the bushes were laughing at me behind their prickly branches. The sun beat down on us, and sweat dripped down the back of my neck, slid under my shirt, and pooled at my waistband. I don't like sweating now, and I certainly didn't like it then. I began to rethink this adventure and was relieved when my friend was ready to go home. My nearly empty basket hung limply from my arm as I trudged back to the car. Not surprisingly, my friend managed to pick a large quantity of the little black jewels. Of course, this was nothing new for her. She was a country girl. I had seen her pantry. It was full of pretty glass jars, just brimming with all of the fresh vegetables that she had grown herself and canned. For a moment, I hated her. I guess she felt sorry for me because she gave me a bunch of her blackberries so I would have enough to make a real cobbler. Back at home, I dumped the berries in a bowl in the sink and pulled out my trusty Betty Crocker cookbook. I flipped the pages until I found the recipe for cobbler. It looked simple enough. According to the directions, I had to rinse the berries and make sure that I had removed all of the sticks, leaves, and trash. That sounded easy. I turned on the water and picked up the berries. As soon as I put my hands into the pile to sort the berries, they burst, staining my hands again and the sink. Now what should I do? I was totally lost. I had to rinse the berries, but if I touched them, they exploded. How the heck was I going to follow Betty's directions and make this stupid cobbler if my berries were juice puddles in the sink? Gingerly, I moved berries around in the bowl, picking out a thorn here and a leaf there. Finally, I decided they were nice and clean. I followed the recipe carefully and popped the cobbler in the oven. Oh, my, this smell was intoxicating. I nearly danced with excitement as I imagined my precious husband's face when he took that first bite. His eyes would roll up in his head, his lids would fall shut, and he would make that satisfied masculine growl in his throat that said, "This is delicious." I couldn't wait. I fixed the rest of our meal, cleaned up my mess, and waited anxiously for his return. When he came through the door, his eyes lit up, a grin split his face, and he asked, "What is that I smell?" Proud of myself, I announced, "Blackberry cobbler made from blackberries I picked today." I felt just like June Cleaver, without the pearls. After we had finished our dinner, I dished up a bowl of warm, juicy cobbler and placed it ceremoniously in front of Reed. I didn't even fix mine yet. I was too excited. He grinned and grabbed a spoon. Digging deeply into the bowl, he loaded the spoon with a huge bite and raised it to his mouth. This was it. The moment of my triumph. I was so excited and full of myself. What a wonderful little wife I was. June Cleaver didn't have anything on me. I watched his face closely, anticipating his expression of delight. He opened his mouth wide and took the whole spoonful into his mouth. He closed his eyes, pulled out the spoon, and began to chew. Suddenly, his eyes flew open wide. He jerked straight up in his chair and pushed back from the table. A strangled squawk came from his throat and his hand jerked to his mouth. Something definitely wasn't right. This wasn't what he was supposed to do. "What? What?" I asked. His fingers probed the roof of his mouth a moment and a grimace crawled across his face. Slowly, he withdrew his fingers and turned his hand so that I could see what was in his palm. "Did you mean to leave this in there?" he asked. In his hand was a small stem with a huge thorn. He had pulled it from the tender skin in the roof of his mouth where it was securely lodged. So much for Betty Crocker. So much for June Cleaver. I wanted to surprise my husband, and I guess I truly did. The interesting thing about that cobbler was that there weren't any other thorns in the entire pan. Reed found that one and only thorn in his very first bite. And yes, we ate every last berry in the dish. We even added a little vanilla ice cream. Looking back over the years, I've decided that marriage is a lot like that blackberry cobbler. It's sweet, warm, delicious, and sometimes it has a thorn or two. Even so, it's worth taking every last bite.
Not to worry, Donna Dillahunty is not a chef in any restaurant. She teaches fifth grade reading and writing in the Marion, Arkansas School District, shares her work with her students, and hopes they learn to recognize the power of their own stories. In our final story of the night, Jeff Llewellyn has no idea what's in store for him, but he'll never forget what happens in I Heard It on the X.
It was a slow night at the college radio station where I DJed when a guy climbed through the second story window, stuck his thumb up at me, and stared as I played a Graham Parker song. I think it was Don't Ask No Questions, so I didn't. He suddenly grabbed a chair, climbed up as high as he could, and began drawing a cartoon likeness of myself. He was quick and not too shabby. He got the glasses just right. He then turned back to me and asked, "Is Fedge spelled with two J's and one F?" That's right, I answered. "It looks better that way." He scribbled the name down under the picture, nodded his head. "You're right, it does look better." He then disappeared out the window before I could thank him. I think his name was Frank. From that point on, I should have known this was not going to be a boring night at the studio. Technically, I had already graduated, but I decided for some strange reason to get my certification to be a public school teacher. So I was taking classes and hanging around for another year or so extra. It was finals week and I was finished, so the radio station manager asked me if I would do the late night show for Monday night. I said sure, because at this point I didn't know when I would ever do another show, and I like late night. I just had to make sure I had enough cokes to keep me awake. If I felt really dangerous, I'd even smoke a cigarette. I'd bought a pack 2 weeks ago, and it was still half full. I think I was the only one on campus who used tobacco as a stimulant. But at 2 a.m., you take what you can get. I was known on the air as Fedge Nellywell, the eternal clone. It would take too long to explain why. Just know that drugs and UFOs were involved. Anyway, I had staggered into the studio a little before 9 p.m. I was planning to stay on until 2 a.m., but you never knew with college radio. I could be conked out by midnight or staying up for the roosters. I brought not one, but two canned Cokes with me because, A, this was 1980 before Starbucks invaded Conway, Arkansas, and B, I wasn't as brave as my former roommate who would bring a six-pack of beer up in a cooler every Friday night for his late-night show. Nope, just caffeine for me. The studio was an office on the second floor of the student union. Graffiti covered every inch of the walls. The portrait I received that night would later hang there, too. The two girls who had the show before mine ran off in a flash, either because of a party or studying, or maybe I just looked strange to them. I was busy queuing up the first two songs to pay much attention. Now, I've lost too many brain cells in the following decades to even guess what the songs were. It's a good bet Elvis Costello was in there somewhere. By the way, this was years before CDs, and we were too poor to have fancy tape machines, so we're talking two old turntables on pedestals, leaving them level with you if you sat in the radio chair. Now, you had to cue them up like primitive DJs using the headphones to hear the first notes of the song. And if you didn't stay on your toes, you could miss a cue and end up with dead air, which encouraged you to play long songs, or two or three from the same album in a row. Now, after the artist Frank disappeared out the window, I was settled in, moving back and forth pretty good, hitting the station IDs between 5 before and 5 after the top of the hour. Then the phone rang. I normally hated to answer the phone during a show. It was usually someone asking for the people who just left or requesting some song I hated. But this was finals week, and I knew there'd be people desperate for that one good song to finish that last term paper. Picked up the phone and said simply, KHDX. The voice was excited. "Why aren't you playing the Beatles?" "I'm not really a big Beatles fan," I fought back a yawn. "Well, John Lennon just got shot." "Yeah, sure," I coughed and swallowed a swig of Coke. "And Paul McCartney shot him, right, yeah." I hung up the phone, drunk college kids, geez, get a life. Several minutes later, the station program director called. "No, really, Fedge, some nut shot him in New York tonight." Jesus, that was all I could get out. "Yeah, they say he blew his head clear off. Lennon didn't even make it to the hospital." "Jesus." "Yeah," he continued, "I really don't think he was listening to me. Howard Cosell talked about him on Monday Night Football." It was still Monday. I felt dizzy and numb. Station manager mumbled something, hung up. I sat there, let the queued up album play on while my brain tried to screw itself back into place. We were a bunch of college kids playing at being on the radio. Our tastes were elitist at best, esoteric, loud, vulgar, and nonsensical. Where would John Lennon and the Beatles fit into that? We had a couple of Beatles records, and both of them were real early stuff. I grabbed one, flung it on the turntable. "I'll Follow the Sun" began to play, and I began to cry. One day you'll look to see I've gone, but tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun. Pretty simple lyrics, nothing special, but it hit hard. Life never looked so fragile. Heroes weren't supposed to go out like this, at least mine weren't. Lennon was supposed to be the smart one, the political troublemaker, the risk taker, out there on the edge for all of us in the dark, dull days of the 20th century, which was rapidly near its sad end. You stick your head out from the trenches and some maniac shoots it off. Welcome to the 80s. I hear there's this guy named Reagan coming soon. I know I can't wait for that. Next thing they'll tell me some guy from Arkansas can be president. I felt a cold, mean chill in the air. I'll just stay in this dark room in Conway playing records and praying for the sun to come up soon. One day you'll know I was the one, but tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun. The great British icon, Doctor Who, often says there are fixed points in time that can never be changed, no matter how many Time Lords come along to try. Fixed point in time indeed, Doctor. Never changing, always repeating in my mind, bittersweet and chaotic. Focus on it too long and it pulls you in. But don't worry about me. Like John said, I'm just sitting here watching the wheels go round and round.
Jeff Llewellyn is an archivist with the Arkansas History Commission and travels around the state giving talks on Arkansas music. His earliest experience in music was as a DJ at KHDX, the Hendrix College radio station in Conway, Arkansas. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Stitcher, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.